She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And trust me when I say we are going to be giving you a lot to think about today. It's a pretty heavy subject, but one about which we all need to pay attention to and be informed about. The show is sponsored by the Fairfax Companies, true leaders in the business of sustainability, and we thank them for their support always. The topic for our show today is, are we making our kids sick? And from where I sit, it's arguably one of the most important issues facing our country today. And we are very fortunate to have someone who is a leading expert in the area of children's health and the environment. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jerome Paulson. Dr. Paulson is the director and professor of pediatrics at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences, and professor of environmental and occupational health at the George Washington School of Public Health and Health Services. He is also the medical director for the National and Global Affairs of the Children's Health Advocacy Institute at Children's National. And I just want to add to that, we get to have on our show today a true visionary. I have read enormous amounts of research about his work, and I feel that Mrs. Green's World is quite fortunate that he's giving an hour of his time after reading all that to share with us some very important information about our children's health. So, Dr. Paulson, that's my big, huge, sincere thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here and happy to chat with you about these important issues, Mrs. Green.
They are really important, and you have a lot of really good stuff to say, so hopefully I have a lot of great questions. Given that you really do wear a myriad of hats, all connected, interwoven, but albeit many of them, in terms of your global leadership for children's health and the environment, I'd like to simply start by asking you, are we making our kids sick, and how sick are they? And I don't mean an intentional, oh, yeah, we want to get our kids sick. That's a given. But our kids are sick. So can you just lay the foundation for the conversation we'll be having?
Sure. I think that there are some exposures that children experience in our world today that we know are not good for their health. And there are many other exposures where we're not sure whether they're bad for their health, but we certainly have reason to worry. So, for example, ozone as a component of air pollution, which comes in part from burning of fossil fuels. We know that ozone is bad for kids, for adults too, for that matter, but bad for kids, damages the lungs of even healthy kids. And for kids who have asthma, for example, ozone can certainly set off asthma attacks. We know that lead, which is still present in many old homes, probably 500,000 or more old homes in the United States, still poisons children, still damages their brains. Even today, more than a century after we've learned that lead poisoning and that lead in paint is hazardous to kids.
And does asbestos fall in there? I heard last night at this lecture that asbestos, there's still no regulatory, it's not outlawed. There, you can't use it in new building from what I understand, but asbestos, is that another troublemaker?
I'm somewhat less concerned about asbestos than some of the other things that I've mentioned.
Okay.
One of the reasons is that while there still may be asbestos in many buildings that were built in the 20th century, if that asbestos is contained, if it's still glued together and doesn't get into the air, then it's not causing a problem. One of the things that's really important to understand about all sorts of toxic chemicals, whether it's asbestos, whether it's pesticides, whether it's medications that go out of our bodies and into water and then back into our bodies with the water that we drink. If those things can't, in fact, get into our body, then they're not hazardous to us. I want everybody to think, for example, if you have a key fob in your purse or in your pocket that you use to open your car door or unlock your car or something like that. Now, I'm sure in that key fob there may be some hazardous chemicals, but holding them in your hand, holding the key fob in your hand or having it in your pocket or your purse is not dangerous because those chemicals are inside the plastic.
Right.
Most of them, even if you touch them with your skin, would not get through the skin into your body. Now, I wouldn't eat your key fob for lunch. That would be a
that's
way.
That's very good advice.
get the chemicals into your body. So the mere presence of a hazardous substance in the same place where there's a human being isn't the important question or the important issue. The issue is, can that substance get into the human being?
And that makes so much sense. So what about things like, does BPA come up high on your radar screen? It lines cans. It's still in plastic bottles. Now they're talking about it's on paper receipts. Is that another one that you're looking at that's making not just kids but us sick?
We know that BPA in laboratory settings and in animal studies is an endocrine-disrupting chemical.
Right.
And so in all likelihood, it plays that role in human beings as well. We don't have definitive evidence that human beings have been made sick by BPA.
Okay.
But there is certainly sufficient evidence to want to minimize, if not eliminate, BPA exposure because of what we know that it does in the lab and in animals. And this speaks to a major issue that we have in the United States and also around the world. And that issue is the general control of chemicals. When you look at chemicals like those that are drugs, they have to be approved before they go on the market.
Right.
The companies that want to market a new drug, which is really a chemical by another name, have to do tests on that chemical. They have to share the results of those tests with the regulatory agency, the Food and Drug Administration. An independent committee looks at those results and helps the Food and Drug Administration decide whether that chemical should go on the market as a drug. And in addition, in the relatively recent past, the FDA also collects information about these chemicals, about these drugs, after they go on the market to see if information comes to light that would not have been determined in the pre-market testing. And I'm not suggesting that anybody is doing anything bad in the pre-market testing, but just there's a vast difference when you test on animals and in laboratories and on hundreds of human beings versus when you give this drug to thousands, if not millions, of human beings.
Okay,
so things
right.
come to light that you wouldn't have otherwise known. But for any other chemical other than drugs, as I've already mentioned, and pesticides, any other chemical does not need pre-market approval before it comes to market. So when issues about BPA were raised, and many companies, I think all companies here in the United States, voluntarily removed BPA from products, they needed another chemical that would do the same thing as BPA, and they looked to a chemical called BPS. And if you look at the data on BPS hazards, there isn't any because there's no requirement for pre-market testing. Now that BPS has come into the market, some researchers are finding that, lo and behold, BPS has some of the same hazards as BPA. So we really need a different paradigm in the United States and around the world that calls for pre-market evaluation of chemicals to see if they're toxic to human beings and animals. We need to know particularly about kids who are not little adults. We need to know particularly about women who are pregnant. And that information must be public before decisions are made about marketing those chemicals.
And just that whole conversation is to me somewhat daunting. I mean, it's really and truly, when you think about all of the discussion and the millions and millions of dollars being spent just in one area, which is, we're not going to go there, but GMO labeling, okay? And look what's happening. And when I think about, you know, launching this massive movement to have pre-market evaluation, it's so encouraging on the one hand, and on the other hand, this is a big deal. And there will be lots of people lining up to shoot any of that down. Do you agree?
Well, the European Union is starting to implement a program that is called, by the initials, REACH, R-E-A-C-H.
Okay.
And this is a program that is starting slowly, but over time will require companies to do pre-market testing, submit those test results to European Union administrative bodies, and then those bodies will make decisions about chemicals being marketed in the European Union. This may become the de facto standard for the whole world, but it may also leave the United States as a dumping ground where if companies can't get chemicals approved in Europe, well, that's fine. They'll just sell them in the U.S. because there's no requirement for pre-market approval.
That is awful. And it's so true. That's what happens with cosmetics. We get the bottom of the barrel, and Europe gets the cream of the crop. That's absolutely a science-based statement. We get lower quality in our cosmetics, and Europe, there are so many other things that they have outlawed that are not allowed to be included in safe cosmetics. So we'll be following the healthy Europeans. I want to try and ask this question succinctly, and it's one that I don't know if there's an easy answer to. Is the rapid acceleration of how many sick kids they are, what created this phenomenon? Even from my generation, like we talk about it all the time at dinners and in social circles about how many kids we know with leukemia, how many kids we know with cancer, how many kids we know with asthma. You know, you can go into the ADD, ADHD, the autism spectrum. How is the environmental health, the historic perspective? Is it just a short period of time in our history? I grew up with vinegar and my mother did use ammonia to clean some things. She didn't spray anything. You know, just our own environment. I didn't feel like we were surrounded by toxic chemicals in the home because she used natural products. So is this something that you've been watching and it's accelerating?
Well, it is true that the use of chemicals in homes, in schools, in workplaces, has accelerated greatly since the end of World War II. And that it is also true that there have been changes in disease patterns in that same time frame, and changes in disease patterns occurring at a rate that are hard to ascribe solely to changes in genetics or other things along those lines. Whether there is a relationship between these two things increasing in the same time frame is a much harder relationship to draw. I think with ozone and asthma, there the relationship is probably the clearest.
Right.
There's very clear data that kids who grow up in areas with higher levels of ozone and who are outdoors a lot, they looked at kids who were playing varsity sports. So, you know, these are kids on the one hand who are extremely active.
Right.
And outside, and compared them to kids who were not in high ozone areas. The kids who played three or more varsity sports, meaning they're so fit that I can barely comprehend the notion of somebody who can qualify for
three
varsity sports. But very clearly, these are the fittest of the fit, yet their risk for developing asthma as a new disease was three times that of comparable children involved in varsity sports, three varsity sports, in low ozone areas.
So the risk for the athletes were three times as much?
As for other athletes playing in low ozone areas.
Okay.
And, you know, when you think about it, when do athletes go out and practice for most sports? They go out at, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
And that's the time of day in most areas when ozone and other pollutant levels are actually the highest.
Elevated, yes. Okay.
Some of this effort to begin high school later in the day, if that also means that they practice in the morning before they start class, may actually be beneficial for kids' health in terms of asthma. We don't know that.
Right.
It's something that should actually be an interesting study as some school systems implement these later start times.
So it's an even earlier would be like do it in the morning or later at night, but that is just an unbelievable observation, and not really just observation, but statistical. It's shocking to me. Let's just say that. I'm like, you got to be kidding. So the very fit are getting sick because they're breathing more. They're doing a lot of, you know, rigorous outdoor activity. So it's a perfect segue to, in your role as medical director for national and global affairs, what do you do with this information? You're assimilating it. You have a worldview. So just for example, with something like that, you have it, you're sharing it here. Are there people carrying that torch and, you know, putting initiatives out there to help reduce the cases of asthma being diagnosed with athletes?
Well, there are certainly large numbers of people working on all sorts of air pollution issues, not just ozone, but particulate matter and things like that. Within the work that I do at Children's National, you mentioned that I'm part of this Child Health Advocacy Institute. And we are essentially a think tank at Children's National Health System. And it's not a large group of people, but we work on different topics related to children's health and policy and try and influence community groups, parents, legislators, executive branch agencies to make the world a healthier place for kids. And so this is the issue of advocacy is something that Children's National has seen as important to teach. Just the issue, how one, as a physician or other health professional, takes the expertise that we have as health professionals and uses that not only in the one-on-one encounter with parents and kids, but also to make greater changes in society.
Okay, we are going to take a short break. It's just what I said to you. This is a two-hour show that will get an hour of you. So everybody, please stay here with me. Dr. Jerome Paulson, the director and professor of pediatrics at George Washington University School of Medicine, and much more. Please stay here with me. We're going to be talking about the Children's National Health System. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine, it's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines, it gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit ChapmanTucson.com.
Find everything you need for your next adventure at Bookman Sports Exchange. Buy it new, buy it used, or trade up and go where you've never been before. Explore this big backyard we call Tucson. Bookman Sports Exchange has the gear you need for anything from a quick day hike in Sabino to a long backpacking trip through the Grand Canyon. Bookman Sports Exchange, open daily, located on Speedway, east of Country Club. For details and more information, visit bookmansports.com.
Ready to clean out that garage? Goodwill offers you 40 convenient locations all over southern Arizona. And at every one, you'll be greeted by a uniformed Goodwill employee trained to assist you in unloading your items, prepared to offer you a receipt for your tax-deductible donation, and grateful for something you won't get anywhere else.
Thank you. Because of your donation, I have a job.
The gift of Goodwill. For a list of Goodwill donation sites, go to goodwillsouthernaz.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And if you are just joining us, get ready to think. If you have joined us from the beginning, I'm sure you are having a lot of thoughts going on in your head. We are talking with Dr. Jerome Paulson. He is the director and professor of pediatrics at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences and professor of environmental and occupational health at the George Washington School of Public Health and Health Services. And he is the medical director for national and global affairs at the Children's Health Advocacy Institute at Children's National. And, you know, Dr. Paulson, we could talk for the rest of the show about Children's National. I mean, this is massive, and it's definitely more than just a hospital. It's from what I can gather, a huge national network of providers that are, you know, sharing your vision. So, where do you want to pick up? We can talk about, you know, you talked about the Children's Health Advocacy Institute and the think tank, and then I'd love for you to talk for a bit about the Children's National Health System, that is massive and hopeful and a treasure trove of great information. Is that a good way to put it?
Yes, thank you very much. I think it is. We're based here in Washington, D.C. Our primary service area incorporates Maryland and Virginia as well, but we really serve patients from across the nation and internationally as well. Some of our, for example, cardiac surgery patients, some of our doctors travel overseas to do their work. Some patients come from all over the world for cardiac surgery at Children's National. The same, for example, with some of the work that's done by our experts on brain cancers. We're consulting with healthcare professionals in Brazil, for example, on a regular basis, and children come from around the world for treatment at Children's National.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just going to say, when you look at the website, which I like to refer people to, it's childrensnational.org. The complexity of the things that you're helping people to be informed about, that shows up, even including the most viewed things on your site. It's a very content-rich and informative site for any parent, I would think, or doctor who is looking for answers for what's going on. So I wanted to give you that plug, and then please go on.
Well, thank you. And one of the other things that we have at Children's National is this Mid-Atlantic Center for Children's Health and the Environment that you referred to. It is one of 10 pediatric environmental health specialty units in the United States. So while the Mid-Atlantic Center serves, as its name implies, the Mid-Atlantic region, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, and the District of Columbia, we are part of a nationwide network of pediatric environmental health specialty units. And so there is a unit doing what we do, which is educate people about environmental issues that impact on children's health and serve as a consultant to parents, docs, nurses, public health officials, radio shows.
Good radio shows.
Right. On topics related to children's health and the environment. So we're part of while we work in our own region, we're really part of a national network. And as complex questions come up, if we don't have the answer, then we talk to our colleagues around the country and multiply our expertise by incorporating the information from all these other academic medical centers around the country.
Yeah, you activate the matrix. And if you have a sick child and know that there are 10 centers helping with what might be a rare diagnosis, it's very assuring. And I've got involved lately with the Lymphoma and Leukemia Society and learned a lot about their national work. And having a national network when there are rare cases diagnosed, I've heard from parents about how much it helps. But let's talk about since we're on this, Mid-Atlantic Center of Children's Health and the Environment. You have had a big conference in September, just very recently. Were there any new emerging or things you'd like to share with us that were major topics of discussion for that conference, like aha moments or a shift in focus, or give us a little report on that, because it was huge.
Sure, happy to do that. The Mid-Atlantic Center has an annual meeting generally in September, and this year we wanted to look at places where kids spend some time. And so we had two tracks within our meeting, one focusing on schools and the other focusing actually on health professional offices. Now, there's a large movement in the United States and around the world for greening big medical centers. And there's been a lot of information created over the last 20 years about how big medical centers can change to reduce their carbon footprint, to use fewer toxic chemicals, and on and on and on.
Right.
But sometimes extrapolating information that's applicable to a multi-million dollar enterprise down to the 5-person or 10-person office practice, whether it's pediatrics or OBGYN or internal medicine or whatever, is kind of difficult. So we brought together a cadre of folks who have been thinking about that to start to spread the word. And we hope to build on that and expand the availability of this information to all healthcare providers who want to improve how they run their office from the standpoint of lowering their carbon footprint, lowering their use of potentially toxic chemicals, the reduce, reuse, recycle that you talk about in your program, but doing that on a scale that's appropriate for an office setting.
Right, right.
And then the other facet of our meeting in September was the issue of environmental exposures that go on in schools. Obviously, second to their home, children spend more time in school buildings than any place else. And if they're going to pre-K care and aftercare in the same building where they go to school, they may spend 12 or 13 hours in that one place every day, which could actually almost be more time than they spend at home.
Right.
So how school, we know that many schools in the United States, the buildings are fairly old. We know in many schools in the United States, there's been a tremendous amount of deferred maintenance. And so the issues that occur in schools, ranging from mold to buildings that may be old enough to still have lead-based paint in them, to the use of pesticides rather than using integrated pest management procedures to take care of pest infestations that occur in schools. There's a whole host of issues. And there are issues for the kids. We should also recognize that teachers and administrators and other staff people spend many hours a day in these buildings. And so if these buildings have environmental problems, they are going to impact the adults there as well as the kids.
It's just amazing to me and fascinating because a lot of my focus in shows recently has been on food and what we're feeding our kids and obesity and juvenile diabetes and all of that. And you, for me, are taking it back to some of the fundamental levels that can be very easily overlooked. It's not like spraying the desks. It's what is in the buildings, what the kids are breathing. I mean, you think about mold. It's becoming a huge issue with even people near and dear to my heart. One of my friend's children got diagnosed with mold in her body that's shutting systems down. I mean, I don't even know where that's going. But lead, lead-based paint and pesticides, huge big picture issues that you are pointing out to me that then, of course, I'll be on that bandwagon because it's like, let's go back to some of the basics instead of we can change food more easily than some of these are big issues with school districts that are hurting for money. And, you know, there's the global visionary picture that you're painting for us, and I appreciate that.
Well, one of the other issues about schools is when it comes to the environmental status of the buildings and the impact of the use of cleaning products, disinfecting products, floor polishes, and all sorts of other things that are used in schools, there's no centralized entity that has any control. The Department of Education at the federal level has no control. The Environmental Protection Agency has no authority from Congress to regulate indoor air anywhere, but specifically does not have any authority to regulate indoor air quality in school buildings. Decisions about whether to use integrated pest management in schools are decisions that are made by individual school districts. And sometimes they're hamstrung by requirements to give contracts to lowest bidders without necessarily taking into consideration issues of health. And if the lowest bidder is proposing to spray pesticides in the school building on a monthly basis, whether it needs it or not, that's not good for the kids or the adults in that building when for probably no more money, maybe a tiny little bit more money, maybe a little less money, there could be an implemented integrated pest management plan that would get rid of the pests and protect the kids and the adults from exposure to known hazardous chemicals. Remember, pesticides are regulated in this country. But the reality is pesticides are designed to kill organisms.
Right.
And that's why we use them. And some of the parts, some of the ways that cockroaches work are some of the ways that our bodies work. And so to think that you can use a chemical that's going to harm a rat or a cockroach or whatnot, and that that same chemical, while not acutely toxic to a human being, has no toxicity to a human being, I don't think you can go that far and say that.
I totally agree. And the impact it has, even I've talked about it with other guests on the show about pets. You know, you have your yard sprayed with these toxic chemicals, which I do not. And then the pets go out. And I will tell you, that's another area where we have more sick pets. The diagnosis for pets, when I grew up, our pets did not have pancreatic cancer and all of these things that the friends of mine are spending inordinate amounts of money on. And of course, I always think it's toxins in the environment. But a really perfect segue for this is I'd love for you to share with us about the pediatric environmental health specialty units. What are they? Where are they? How they can help families. Is this what addresses some of the things that you just talked about?
All of your listeners can find out about the regional PESU that serves their specific part of the country by going to www.pehsu.net.
.net, okay.
So the federal government divides the country into 10 regions, and there's one pediatric environmental health specialty unit in each region. We are all based at academic medical centers. We are funded indirectly by a part of the Centers for Disease Control called the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, and also by the EPA. We don't take any funds from any commercial organizations of any sort. And our mission is to take the scientific information that's available, explain that to health professionals and others in the region where we work, and use that scientific information to help those health professionals, parents, teachers, public health officials deal with issues that involve the environment, children, and health. As you are well aware, Mrs. Green, and I'm sure you've heard this from many of your other guests over the years, we don't have the information in some instances that we would like to have. And I noted before, there's no mechanism, for example, to screen chemicals before they come on the market. So sometimes we're hampered with lack of information in terms of what we can help people with. But our job is to take the science and as it exists and help people understand what's going on in their homes, in their communities, in their schools, how to protect their kids, how to prevent exposures that might be toxic.
And you know, Dr. Paulson, we're going to have to take a break again in 2 minutes, and I really wanted you to share with us what I called when I off air the Children's Bill of Rights that a bunch of visionary leaders got together, a large, impressive collection gathering of people. But as a parent, you know, I'm reacting to what you're saying at a visceral level as a parent because I think I was a really good parent, and so many of these things I did not think about when I sent my kids to school. I did not think about their integrated pest management. You know what I mean? I'm sure the schools I went to were 12 years of Catholic school, old lead paint. I'm pretty healthy. But the piece that is so intriguing to me and that I want to be a part of is how do we get the word out about the important work you're doing to raise the awareness of among parents. You send your child to school and there's a trust. I'm sending my child to school and there's good teachers and there's good principals. And how do we you know, kind of ring the alarm bell appropriately so that parents are better educated and then can help be advocates for spending that extra money for the integrated pest management. So that's my little diatribe on thank you. So everybody stay here with us. Lots more great information from Dr. Paulson about children and their health and connection to the environment. I am in awe. So please stay here with me. We've got a lot of good stuff to share in the last half of the show.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World, next.
Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
We rely on your generosity for our inventory. Homeowners, renters, contractors, and business owners keep the Habit Store stocked with building supplies, furniture, and appliances. You can drop off your donations or give us a call at 889-7200 to schedule a free pickup of items that are in good condition. Your donations means Habitat Tucson can build and renovate more homes for hardworking people. The Habit Store's hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturday, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road just east of I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And in this particular case, for everyone who's listening to the show, we are asking you to think. Think about, are we making our kids sick? What can we do about it? And how to become advocates for children's health. Whether you have children or not, it affects all of us in many ways. Our guest today is Dr. Jerome Paulson. He is the director and professor of pediatrics at George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences, and professor of environmental and occupational health at the George Washington School of Public Health and Health Services. And he is the medical director for national and global affairs of the Children's Health Advocacy Institute at Children's National. And as I added in the second segment, a true visionary. And we are really blessed to have you, Dr. Paulson, and having you, you know, just share with us such important information about our future, because I have been in children's services most of my life before Mrs. Green was born, and I worked in managing large volume mental health contracts, and I would say to groups, children are our future. They're the only future we've ever had, so let's take care of them. And I just have to do a quick shout out. I want to remind everybody we have a membership program, Help Keep Us Alive and Growing Healthy, by becoming a supporter of Mrs. Green's World, to bring to you broadcasts that are free and independent like that. It's very easy to become a member by visiting our website. There's a membership level for every budget. Click on our Preserve the Planet icon. And also, we do have an app, and I keep promoting that because it's helping with our distribution greatly. It's called Igloo. It's free. Go to our website, IGLU, and you get your free mobile app for any of your mobile devices, which is where most people are listening. So back to Dr. Paulson. Is there anything else that you wanted to add about the, I think you called them PSUs, with,
yeah.
That's, I love it. I love acronyms, and that one sounds kind of fun, and this is a pretty heavy topic. I'm usually a little bit lighter on the show, but when it comes to children and the enormity of what I think the issues are, it's pretty heavy-duty stuff that we need to be engaged with and be a part of the solution.
I just want to remind your listeners that they can get information about all of the pediatric environmental health specialty units, all of the PESUs, at www.tehsu.net. each of the individual units around the country has a toll-free number, so it's not even a long-distance phone call for parents or school board members or physicians, nurses. There should not be any barrier to contacting the PESU in your region to ask the question that you have. They're not a poison control center, so it's not the kind of place that, you know, you call when, heaven forbid, your child's gotten into something in grandma's purse. But it's more the long-term kinds of exposures, what would happen if the school decided to, you know, do X, Y, or Z in terms of how its athletic field, or they want to do some roof renovations in the apartment building where we live. What might the health impacts of that be? So these are the kinds of questions that the PESUs are set up to answer. We have pediatricians, we have toxicologists, we have access, because we are all at medical centers, to the whole range of pediatric specialists if we need them. So the PESUs are quite a useful source of information for all sorts of people, again, ranging from parents to health professionals.
You know, is that an area that you personally see hope in? I, from where I sit as Mrs. Green and talking and really traveling a lot around the country, I see a lot of hope where parents are getting more aware that they have to be aware. Does that make sense? They're not just sending their kids off to school. First of all, so many of my friends' kids, our children's children, have food allergies extraordinaire, and there's peanut-free schools, and there's this and that, and it's kind of a, you know, a, it creates synapses and synergy about awareness. You are absolutely global. Do you feel a lot of hope in terms of more parents getting on board and their awareness about these issues?
I am more hopeful, and I would also say that it's absolutely essential for parents to be aware, but it's also important to recognize that parents can't be responsible for understanding and integrating all of the myriad of things that impact on their kids' lives today. I'm not at all trying to demean parents and say, you know, I'm the doctor and I know more than you.
Right.
But it's, parents need to understand educational policy as well as they need to understand environmental policy, as well as they need to understand issues of, you know, parks and recreation and food and on and on and on. So I think parents should demand that the government, which is created by the people to provide information and support beyond what any individual family can do, that the government take its role and responsibility to protect society from these hazards. We just went through an election, and so, you know, parents should be thinking when they go into that election booth, every time they go into that election booth, is this person that I'm voting for going to put the best interests of my child vis-a-vis climate change, vis-a-vis chemical management policy, vis-a-vis water pollution or air pollution? Is this candidate going to help protect my child from these threats to my child's health? That may not be the only factor that parents, and probably shouldn't be, the only factor that parents take into account, but it clearly should be one of the factors.
I just want to ring a bell. I mean, I want to ring a bell and say, are you listening to Dr. Polson? Because I will tell you, that is not the topical trend that was very prevalent at all, if at all, in our election here in Arizona. I mean, it's you're really ringing a bell for a kind of awareness that needs to be incorporated. So, I don't mean to interrupt, but I have to get my enthusiasm out a little bit. I'm sounding like a little bit like a cheerleader here, but what an important message to send to parents. And there are thousands of people that listen to this podcast that are going to say, aha, you're right. That's a really good point. And we'll get it out in our social media. And I think it's a perfect segue, because I don't want the show to be over without you talking about what happened on October 20th, just a few short weeks ago, where visionary leaders across sectors, I mean, we're talking people that were represented nonprofits, environmental justice, child health, urban planning, I'm going to read some more, academia, public health, businesses, economics, public policy, law, and agriculture. I mean, I don't think I missed any of them, gathered at Wingspread in Wisconsin, which I've been there, so that made me, lots of magic happens at Wingspread. I think it's a pretty impressive place. So what happened there, and what kind of vision did you help create for protecting children's environmental health? You can probably talk about that for the rest of the show. It's that impressive.
I think we probably could, and thank you very much for bringing this up. The group that convened us all is the Children's Environmental Health Network. And again, for your listeners, www.cehn.org. The Children's Environmental Health Network is one of the oldest non-governmental organizations working in the area of children's environmental health, as its name implies. And I actually got some of my early education in this field of children's environmental health as a result of programs that the network had in the early 1990s. So they convened this broad group of individuals across the range of areas of expertise that you mentioned to try and envision how we should move forward as a culture and as a society to protect children from environmental threats to their health. And we said that all children have a right to breathe clean air. And this is a right to breathe clean air, eat safe and healthful food, drink pure water, and enjoy toys and products free from environmental health and safety threats. All children have the right, again, the right to healthy, safe, and secure homes, child care facilities, schools, and communities. And all children and their parents and caretakers have the right to know that proven and potential hazards to their environmental health and safety and to protection from these threats. So we want to use this Wingspread statement, vision for protecting children's environmental health, as a foundation for change in our own society here in the United States as well as globally. We want people in decision-making roles in our society to put children first. Mrs. Green, you yourself said children are our future, and if we don't put children first and protect children from hazards that we know about, from hazards where we have a very high degree of concern, even if not certainty, then we are not doing what we should be doing as a culture, as a society, as a group of individuals of all sorts of races, religions, backgrounds, income levels, and whatnot. We are not doing what we should do to better the future for ourselves and our children and our children's children. So the network brought us together. We put this statement together, and now individually and As groups, we will go forward to encourage others to incorporate the sentiments of this document in the work that they do on a day-to-day basis. This could, in the best of all possible worlds, become foundational documents for departments of environmental quality in counties and states throughout the nation. It could become a foundational document incorporated into aspects of work done by health departments around the country. Child care centers should adopt this and
right.
implement these principles as they take care of the kids in their for whom they have responsibility. Likewise, schools and universities and workplaces. So on and on and on. We think that these concepts will lead to a healthier world for our kids.
And in colleges of education and in medical schools, I mean, if it's okay, I would like to just read the first paragraph. And I already put it up on Facebook when I was doing the research for the show. And we live in such a five-second world, Instagram and hurry up, and you can't hold people's attention for more than 15 seconds. I encourage our listeners to a call to action to read this from beginning to end and tell me you're not inspired. So the first paragraph, we believe that every child has an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Fundamental to that vision is the right of all children to play and learn, to breathe, eat and drink, and to dream safely, cradled by their families and communities. All children should live free from violence, racism, poverty, hunger, life trauma, and poisons that will keep them from living to their full potential. Indeed, society's soul is truly revealed by the way in which it treats its children. Now, visionaries wrote that statement, and I was like, wow, this is a big wow that paints the big picture of our moral obligation to protect and nurture our children's health. And I just got obviously quite passionate and emotional when I was referred to do research at that part of the show. So thank you for being a part of that and for bringing it to light for us. And we're going to do our part to spread the word. I'm going to get on some mommy bloggers' Twitter feeds so that they can, you know, the mommy bloggers are changing the world in many wonderful ways, too. So we have about 3 minutes left, and I would love you to, if you can, what would your one or two calls to action be for people that are listening? All people, parents, grandparents, scientists, teachers. I've got a very diverse following. What would you say, here's my call to action as a visionary that helped craft this statement?
We know a lot about things in the environment that harm kids. We need to develop the will to manage those things so that the harm to children is decreased, even if we can't totally eliminate that harm.
Right.
We also know of many things where there's a tremendous amount of evidence that there may not be harm, but at this point in time, we don't have absolute proof. We should not have a system that requires absolute proof of harm before making changes that are likely to protect the health of children. In this country, we way too often demand certainty when certainty only forestalls protecting children. And we can't do that. We need to put children first. They have a right to a clean, healthful environment that promotes their growth and their well-being. And by working locally, by working regionally, statewide and nationally, we can change society.
But become advocates for kids. Yes.
Right.
Okay.
Parents and others, we need to do this.
Great guest, great vision. Dr. Paulson, thank you so much. Everybody, check out my website for the upcoming shows. We are out of time. Thank you so much.